President Trump's international allies have remained silent on the U.S. election so far, but other world leaders are congratulating President-elect Joe Biden and feeling somewhat optimistic.
I think people are hugely relieved that the Trump administration will not have a second term. It was too dramatic, too chaotic, too unpredictable, and people are relieved to see a new administration.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, November 10th, how a Biden administration could bring a more familiar approach to the world stage and what world leaders are thinking about our election. Also on the show, this election cycle, Americans had to contend with disinformation, long lines, and a pandemic. So what needs to happen to get back voter faith?
Voters need to have trust in a system that is accurate and representative. It is becoming increasingly clear that the Electoral College impedes that trust and impedes that confidence.
Plus, President-elect Biden might be preaching unity, but we conduct a postmortem on where the Democratic Party goes from here. But first,
Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who has now tweeted, "Congratulations, Joe Biden, on your spectacular victory."
I join with other nations' leaders around the world in congratulating.
I congratulate.
And on behalf of New Zealand, recognize and congratulate.
I want to congratulate President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris.
U.S. allies around the world have moved quickly to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris on their win, even as President Trump still refuses to concede the election. For countries like Canada, France, and Germany, Biden's victory could signal a return to cooperation on alliances like NATO and treaties including the Paris Climate Agreement. But the prospect of a Biden administration seems less promising to more authoritarian leaders with whom President Trump forged strong relationships during his time in office, including North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, Chinese President Xi Jinping, who so far have all refrained from publicly congratulating Biden and Harris. Joining me now is Yasmin Serhan, London-based staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks for joining us again, Yasmin.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Klaus Lades, professor of history and international affairs at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Klaus, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Hello. How are you doing?
All right. We are in a very interesting political moment right now. The President Trump has refused to concede, and yet President-elect Biden is moving forward and the world is noticing. Klaus, how would you describe the scope so far of the international reaction to Biden's victory?
Well, on the whole, I think there has been a lot of rejoicing, a lot of applause for Biden. I think people are hugely relieved that the Trump administration will not have a second term. And most people, most leaders in Europe and Asia and people in their countries are really overjoyed. I think they were really getting fed up with the Trump administration. It was too dramatic, too chaotic, too unpredictable. And people are relieved to see a new administration.
Klaus, you said the administration was dramatic and unpredictable, and I think many Americans would agree with you, but it continues to be dramatic and somewhat unpredictable, given the fact that the Trump administration is now calling for recounts and investigations into what they allege are voter inconsistencies. Are world leaders looking at that and saying anything about that, the fact that there still has not been a concession from President Trump?
Well, they're all shaking their heads, or most of them are shaking their heads, but they keep their thoughts to themselves, because it is no point to interfere in what is seen as domestic American politics. Very few people, at least very few Democratic leaders, have any understanding for what is going on in Washington. It seems to be pretty obvious that the election was free and was not done in a fraudulent way at all. And over 4 million people, you know, voted for Biden rather than for Trump. So the majority was 4 million, the popular vote. He won with 4 million people. And, you know, people have accepted that Biden is president-elect and will be the new president. But they are, you know, wondering what's going on in Washington. But hardly anyone is actually surprised that the Trump administration would embark on such a course of action, because that fits in with what his administration was like. Chaotic, dramatic, unpredictable, and quite irrational to some extent.
Yasmin, given what Klaus just laid out there in terms of the continued reaction to the world leaders, at least U.S. allies saying, you know, okay, we'll kind of watch what's happening and see how this all plays out. How much of the reaction, you think, is excitement about Biden himself versus relief about removing President Trump from office?
It's a great question. I mean, it's worth noting, and I thought kind of Klaus's overview is spot on, that, you know, for a lot of world leaders, Biden is a very familiar character. He's certainly not new to the world stage. I think it was in Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister's congratulations, that he noted that he's known Biden for 40 years. And I think a lot of world leaders know Biden. So it's, I think probably if I had to guess, my assessment would be that it's probably the latter. I think a lot of the protests you were seeing in the U.S. in the days after the result was finally announced was probably felt, at least to me as an American observing from afar, like a lot more relief than necessarily, you know, excitement. This isn't to say that, you know, folks don't like Biden or aren't excited to see him at the helm. He's, as I said, a recognizable figure. But I think the world generally kind of just took a big sigh of relief that, you know, here returns a U.S. administration that recognizes the U.S.'s traditional role in the world and will hopefully be kind of retaking that spot on the international stage.
And Yasmin, you are in London, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson has had a strong relationship with President Trump. How do you think this relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. will evolve under a Biden administration?
It's a really good question. There's certainly been a lot of chatter about that very thing here, kind of leading up to the U.S. election. And now after that, we know the result. I think there was some conjecture that, you know, obviously, as you just said, President Trump and Prime Minister Johnson had a pretty good relationship. I think a lot of that stemmed from the fact that President Trump was quite a big supporter of Brexit. And, you know, I think kind of quite appreciated the sort of comparisons between him and Johnson, superficial as some of them may be. Particularly, I think he quite liked references to Johnson as Britain Trump, if I'm remembering correctly. And there has been some talk about some potential tensions between a Biden administration and Johnson's Downing Street, particularly with regard to Brexit. Biden has been very clear about his support for the Good Friday Agreement and opposing anything that would undermine it. And I think there's also some talk about how, you know, Johnson, before he was prime minister, had made some comments with regard to President Obama's support for Britain staying in the EU, where I think he made comments about Obama's Kenyan ancestry and how he had an ancestral dislike of the British Empire. So these are no doubt comments that a Biden administration will probably remember well. But I think it's worth noting that, you know, these are things that I do not think are going to shake up the UK-US relationship in a major way. I think there's a lot more that Johnson and Biden share, particularly with regard to issues like climate change, like the Iran deal. And yeah, I mean, I think more broadly, I would expect pretty good relations between the U.S. and the U.K. going forward. While it's certainly true that Trump and Johnson had a decent relationship, I think, you know, the U.K. is certainly a country that would see its relationship with the U.S. being important, irrespective of who's in power.
Klaus, does that same theory hold true for other EU leaders like Angela Merkel, for example, and Emmanuel Macron, who themselves had troubled relationships with President Trump and who I can imagine so far are somewhat relieved to see this new administration elect?
Yeah, they are. But regarding Johnson, I would say that Johnson does feel a little insecure. He was the first international leader, I believe, who phoned up Biden and congratulated him. I think that shows the level of insecurity. And also Biden's Irish background will make him wonder how much he can support on the United States in the future when the United Kingdom needs a trade deal with the U.S. And I think he is worried, you know. I think he would probably have seen a second Trump administration as being more helpful. Regarding Angela Merkel and other European leaders, they certainly were relieved. Angela Merkel had a very bad relationship with Trump, or rather put it the other way around, you know. Merkel tried on various occasions to make overtures to Trump. It was Trump who really rejected it, who couldn't really in the end stand Angela Merkel. And I think he had a problem with female leaders. He had a problem with leaders who were much more open to immigration and to do something about asylum, people who were looking for asylum in their countries, than he could understand. And he also always criticized the EU, including Germany, for its huge trade deficit with the United States, or rather the United States, of course, had the trade deficit with the EU. And he almost criticized the EU and its trade policies as much as he did China. He called the EU actually a foe, which is, you know, really surprising that you consider your most longest standing allies in the world, that you suddenly regard them as foes, at least in trade relations. So Angela Merkel and the German establishment, as well as the French and other foreign policy establishments in Europe, are hugely relieved that they see the end of the Trump administration. And as Yasmin just said, Biden has a very good reputation. He is regarded, to be quite honest, as perhaps a little too old for the job. But on the other hand, he's a centrist. He's not extreme, neither on the left nor the right. People know him. They appreciate his personality. He's a people's person. Some would say he's a backslapping sort of politician, but much more extrovert, much more outgoing, and much more ready to compromise than Trump was. So all that shouting at NATO summits or G7 summits, all that very bad atmosphere, the tension, the talk about the breakup of NATO and the talk about that Trump wanted to undermine the cohesion of the political union of the European Union, all that will be a thing of the past, because Biden and his administration can be expected to be very constructive toward NATO and toward the EU. However, having said that, maybe as a last thought, Biden will also insist on the Europeans spending more money on their defense efforts. So he will not be softer regarding NATO and regarding the defense effort of the Europeans. And here, Europe really needs to do something, because that is an old complaint which goes back to the Obama administration and before. That wasn't actually unique to the Trump administration. And the Europeans know that, and they are very reluctant to spend more on defense. But I think perhaps President Biden will actually be more successful in persuading them that that would be the right thing to do.
Klaus, you mentioned Joe Biden's age, and I think that's something that we must talk about, because if something happens to Joe Biden, we could be looking at a President Kamala Harris. And I'm wondering, this is something that came up yesterday in our conversation about the role that Black women played in American democracy in electing Joe Biden. We've seen Kamala Harris is the first woman of color to ever sit in that role, and I wonder how she will be received by world leaders. Yasmin, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, obviously that history making of her being elected as the first female vice president of color is obviously huge, certainly noteworthy among a lot of the congratulations that were received. I think it was Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India who actually dedicated an entire tweet just to Kamala Harris herself. And I think the reason for that is obvious. Obviously, her Indian heritage, he sees that as an opportunity to even, like, you know, further strengthen the relationship between India and the U.S. But yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, I would anticipate, as you say, given President-elect Biden's age, that, you know, Kamala Harris could have a more hands-on role than previous vice presidents that we've seen. And for that reason, we may find that world leaders will quickly get to know Kamala Harris in a way that perhaps they didn't get to know vice presidents of the past. And it seems, just based on the comments that we've seen, I think Angela Merkel also kind of made a comment about looking forward to meeting Kamala Harris, that we could expect that, you know, the world will be paying attention to both of them very much, not just Biden.
Klaus, what's been the reaction from China and President Xi Jinping?
So far, there hasn't been much of a reaction. Xi Jinping has kept quiet. We don't quite know why. There's speculation that perhaps Xi Jinping doesn't want to antagonize the Trump administration while it is still in office, because in 10 weeks you can do a lot of harm. And he knows that relations between China and the United States are difficult as they are. They will continue to be difficult under the Biden administration. So he's keeping a low profile. On the social media in China, there have, however, been lots of comments. Some people are really regretful that Trump is leaving, because it made the United States weaker. It created a vacuum in international affairs, which was appreciated by some observers in China. Others believe, you know, it is much better to have a more stable, more predictable government, even if that government is perhaps more strategic in its relations with China, but they appreciate that possible predictability in international affairs. So essentially, it's difficult to say what the leadership actually thinks, and we will have to wait until eventually Xi Jinping and the foreign ministry in Beijing will come out with a statement, but they will do so. Nothing at the latest once that domestic insecurity about the election outcome has been resolved. Then they, of course, will congratulate Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
Now, of course, Klaus, one country that we know has been watching the disarray in the United States, or at least the tension in the United States, has been Russia. What have we heard, if anything, from Vladimir Putin and or his administration so far?
Again, Russia is keeping a low profile. Putin hasn't congratulated Biden, and he is keeping quiet. There's not much coming out of Russia. But they, of course, are disappointed that Trump did not win a second term. And there's been talk about disinformation campaigns, not quite as much as in 2016. But Russia did its bit to perhaps enable a second Trump victory. And Trump, however, to be quite frank, hasn't been soft on Russia. The administration, perhaps not the president personally, who always had that soft spot for Putin and very confidential talks with him, and no one really knows what went on during these talks. But when you look at his policy, or his administration's policies towards Russia, that wasn't soft at all. He imposed over 40 times new sanctions on Russia. So the administration actually hasn't been soft on Putin, but I believe that Russia feels that the unpredictability and the chaos and the, let's say, less focused way of the Trump administration than what you can normally expect from an American administration, that in the end helped Russia, that often the president closed both eyes, and that influenced also the foreign policy makers in his administration, like in the State Department.
Yasmin, another interesting figure here is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been a very close ally of President Trump, and that even translated into votes here in the United States for the president from certain Jewish Orthodox communities. He congratulated Joe Biden and Kamala Harris this past weekend. What do you expect to see from Benjamin Netanyahu in the near term when it comes to U.S.-Israeli relations under Joe Biden?
I think this is something that doesn't just apply to Benjamin Netanyahu, but other leaders who have had good relationships with President Trump. I think Narendra Modi also falls into this category. And even figures like Viktor Orban and Rodrigo Duterte, both of whom have also congratulated President-elect Biden. But, you know, I think Netanyahu in particular is a leader who obviously has a vested interest in maintaining a good U.S.-Israel relationship, irrespective of who's in the White House. It's no secret that obviously he benefited quite a lot from having President Trump in the White House, the moving of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem being obviously one of those kind of hallmark examples of a win for him. That said, he obviously, you know, he recognizes that the administration is changing, and I think he wants to shore up that relationship. But, you know, it's been reported that the Trump administration is hoping to kind of work with the Israelis to sort of apply some more punitive measures on Tehran before Trump leaves the White House in the form of sanctions to kind of make it more difficult for Biden to return to the Iran nuclear deal and try to bring that back. This isn't to say that Netanyahu and Biden would necessarily see eye to eye on a lot of things. I think we would probably see, under a Biden administration, a return to the bit of the more traditional tone that we've known the U.S. to take vis-a-vis Israel, you know, opposition to settlement expansion, that sort of thing, support for a two-state solution. But indeed, it will not be as rosy of a friendship as we've seen between Netanyahu and Trump, that's for sure.
We should also note that President Trump's administration was also very close with Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil. Both are considered to have really supported populist movements. And I'm wondering whether or not Jair Bolsonaro, who's also refrained from congratulating Harris and Biden on their win, and other populist movements across the world are looking at this and saying, well, maybe this signals a change here.
I think it's definitely a loss for them. It's a setback because, you know, I think particularly for leaders like Bolsonaro, who really sort of, you know, played on his relationship with President Trump domestically. I think this is a loss because, you know, even before, particularly with populist movements, even in places unlike Brazil where they aren't in power, they could turn and look to President Trump and tell their supporters, look, you know, he's able to achieve this in the United States, so we can achieve it here. If, you know, the most powerful leader in the world can do this, then we can do this where we are. So without question, I think it's a setback for them. They lose that, you know, that key ally in the White House. But that said, I think, you know, populist leaders, like-minded leaders to Trump, who could potentially, you know, take that narrative and sort of utilize it in their favor. So while it is a loss for them, I don't necessarily think that it will end sort of their relationship with Trump or will end them using Trump as sort of an example to their benefit.
Yasmin Sirhan is a London-based staff writer at The Atlantic, and Klaus Lattice is a professor of history and international affairs at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanks so much to you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
The 2020 presidential election was a singular experience for many Americans, marked by a worsening global pandemic, long lines at the polls, and a historic amount of mail-in ballots. But with the counting almost through and the president-elect named, we're going to step back today and look at how it all actually played out and what we might be able to learn for future elections. For that, I spoke to Mirna Perez, director of the Brennan Center's Voting Rights and Elections Program. And I started by asking her first about the flood of mail-in ballots this year.
I think we need to focus on how much better we had done than when we started. I actually think that it is remarkable how much progress we made. More voters than ever had the opportunity to vote by mail. More states than ever gave voters the opportunity to correct technical defects. More states than ever allowed voters additional extra time for their ballots to return. Having said that, we are not a country that is prepared for all universal vote by mail. We will continue to need our polling places. And it is really, really important that we take this time to figure out what we learned from the last election experience. And to me, that means we don't want to be in a position where we are playing catch up, where we are figuring out where our systems aren't working and we're trying to fix them in response to a problem. We, in fact, should go into every election season knowing that we are prepared to handle whatever contingencies are needed. Because this year, it was a once in a century pandemic. But in other years, it may be foreign cyber criminals crippling our infrastructure or really bad weather.
You know, one of the things that surprised me being here in New York, where this was one of the first times we've ever had expanded early voting or early voting in general, were the lines. Why do we still have long lines, even though people had more time to vote?
I'm thrilled that you asked that question, because I believe that long lines are a per se problem, right? They are evidence that something did not go as well as it could have been. And it's hard to know exactly what the problem was. In some instances, it may be that we didn't have enough poll workers that were trained to be able to handle the kind of quirky things that voters are putting in front of them. It may be that we didn't have good line management. It may be that we didn't have enough polling places because we did a poor job predicting how many people would show up. I know that you'll have a lot of people say that it was unexpected enthusiasm and turnout, and that is true. But the big question I would ask is, why was it unexpected? Like, why weren't they preparing for a scenario in which we had lots and lots of voters showing up? So my hope is that we take a look at this election and figure out what could have been better and make it a point of trying to make those things better. Because I do believe, and I think Americans believe, that our elections are too important to depend upon voters taking heroic lengths in order to be able to cast a ballot. This should be something that is easy and accessible no big deal. It's that way in other countries. Other countries manage to be able to have people voting without a lot of like hand-wringing and drama. And in part, it happens so challenging in this country because we chronically underfund and under-resource our elections.
You know, there's been a lot made of who has the last word on election processes. We know now, at least so far, the Supreme Court has put that emphasis back on the states to be able to manage their processes. But, you know, to your point about why this is so difficult in the United States, I just keep wondering, why don't we just have one system to vote, where the ballots look the same everywhere, where the machinery is the same everywhere, where the deadlines are the same everywhere? I mean, I think this election in particular was so utterly confusing for so many people who were just trying to find their ballots, trying to figure out where to cast them, how to cast them, where not to cast them, where to wait in line. I mean, this system just doesn't seem like it's working at all. And I think international observers would agree with that.
Our elections are run by our states, which means we don't just have one system, we have 50 systems. And in some ways, that's a lot of risk diversification, because that means that if something goes wrong in one state, it doesn't become a national problem. It can be fixed in a localized way. It also means that different states can fine-tune what they need for their communities, and states are allowed to set different laws under certain circumstances. What I do think we need, and what I think that there are opportunities to try and push for, is minimum federal standards in federal elections, so that states and localities have the option of doing better than a floor, but there is a floor that voters can experience. I also think that the media needs to think about how it is that they report election issues, because I think it's very clear that in trying to educate voters about things that can go wrong, they nationalize one-offs. We're not doing a good enough job of it landing that people really only need to worry about the problems in their state when it comes to their ability to vote. And so I do think we did a disservice to some voters by nationalizing one-offs.
Let's talk a little bit about the how to voting. Some of us may recall the Shelby v. Holder decision by the Supreme Court a few years back that essentially, you know, limited a lot of the power of the Voting Rights Act. Here we are in 2020. There's been lots of talk about voter disenfranchisement. And at the same time, there have been so many efforts made to register voters to the polls. How do you see the future of our voting process under this current Supreme Court, which in many folks would say are really hostile to voting rights?
I'm so glad you asked that. I think, first of all, it is very obvious that we need a new Voting Rights Act. We need a robust Voting Rights Act. We need a Voting Rights Act that responds to the court critique in Shelby County versus Holder. And we need to build a case for that in the court of public opinion. There were tons and tons of instances in which it was reported that voters were having issues with intimidation or people not understanding the rules. And that is something we can fix and something we should fix. But I don't think we should depend upon the courts to be the one to fix it. It's one of three branches of government. We need to make sure that the people and that the legislature understand that voters care about voting, and that voters believe in the promise that this country made via the 15th Amendment, that when you step into the ballot box, you will be free from racial discrimination in voting. If we could have voters make it very clear to politicians and candidates that they will not tolerate vote suppression, I think we wouldn't be seeing politicians try it.
The Electoral College has been something that's been in the conversation, you know, at so many levels at the last couple of presidential elections. The big question here is, you know, should it be done with? Is the Electoral College a relic of the past that really doesn't reflect the will of the American people?
The Brennan Center certainly believes that the Electoral College should be reformed, and it should, and that the popular vote should elect the president. People are looking at things like different state compacts to try and bring that about. I think ultimately, voters need to have trust in a system that is accurate and representative. And it is becoming increasingly clear that the Electoral College impedes that trust and impedes that confidence. And at a time where Americans are increasingly expecting our institutions of power to be inclusive and representative, it's one of a number of issues that I think is going to be the subject of a lot of serious conversations. Like, we are in a position where we need to be rethinking our structures and our systems. And the Electoral College is no exception.
Mirna Perez is the director of the Brennan Center's Voting Rights and Elections Program. Mirna, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Texas doctors confront the reality of the abortion ban.
A violation of the law could result in a first-degree felony charge and a fine of at least $100,000. After Roe was overturned, the message from doctors was, I'm out of here.
Revisiting the abortion laws in Texas. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
After a divisive and tumultuous 4 years under the Trump administration, President-elect Joe Biden has called for unity among Americans. But he may have to start with his own party. Here's moderate Democrat and Virginia Representative Abigail Spanberger on a private call with other House members last week following Joe Biden's win.
And we need to not ever use the word socialist or socialism ever again. Because while people think it doesn't matter, it does matter. And we lost good members because of that.
On the flip side, progressives like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez pushed back against claims by centrists like Spanberger on Sunday on CNN's State of the Union.
When we kind of come out swinging, not 48 hours after Tuesday, when we don't even have solid data yet, pointing fingers and telling each other what to do, it deepens the division in the party, and it's irresponsible. It's irresponsible to pour gasoline on these already very delicate tensions in the party.
For more on the tensions simmering within the Democratic Party and how the party moves forward, we're joined now by Charlotte Alter, senior correspondent at Time and author of The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Joel Payne, Democratic strategist, CBS News political contributor, and host of the podcast, Here Comes the Payne. Joel, great to have you on the show.
Good to be with you.
So, Joel, there seem to be two major camps within the Democratic Party today, and we just heard a little bit of that back and forth. What's at the root of all of this?
Well, what's at the root of all of this is credit and blame. Who gets credit for Joe Biden winning? Who gets blame for the losses in the House Democratic Caucus? And what's interesting to me, and I've repeatedly said this on a couple of appearances, in the aftermath of the election, is, you can count on Democrats to always snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. I mean, this was a good week for Democrats that we're talking about. You're talking about Joe Biden's going to win by probably nearly 5 million electoral votes, rather 5 million popular votes, over 300 electoral votes. He's going to flip five states. Democrats are going to net two seats in the Senate, and they're going to hold the House. Yes, there were some losses, but that is, by any account, a pretty good week in your kind of political evolution as a party. However, the fact that there were some losses in some kind of frontline vulnerable seats for Democrats, that's the genesis of all of this. I think I probably align a little bit more with the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez view of the world, which is it's probably not the time really to be cannibalizing each other. And I do think that there is an active effort to try to maybe reclaim the party from the progressives. You've heard not only Abigail Spanberger, but you've heard folks like Jim Clyburn being very vocal at trying to assess that blame. We'll see where it all shakes out. But this is the ultimate credit blame game that we're in the midst of right now.
Charlotte, to that point, I mean, we've heard a lot about the back and forth here between progressives, and a lot of progressive voters, you know, did not, Joe Biden was not their candidate, but they voted for him anyway. And the sense is that they're going to keep his and Harris's feet to the fire during the, particularly the first 100 days. But how have we seen this division play out in the past week, Charlotte?
So I think the big problem for Democrats is that, you know, the energy in the party is at one end of this spectrum, on the progressive end of the spectrum, but the swing votes that they need to hold the House, to win the Senate, and to win the presidency are on the other side of that spectrum. And we saw that play out very clearly in the primary when, you know, Bernie Sanders had this extremely energetic, extremely organized and effective base of young and not young, but most young people were with Bernie Sanders in this primary in 2020. They were extremely organized, they were extremely enthusiastic, they were extremely devoted, they ran a terrific campaign. And yet the places that the Democratic candidate needed to win in order to win the nomination and then win the presidency are simply not that progressive. You know, if only New York and California and big cities like Detroit and Chicago and Minneapolis, if those were the only places that decided political outcomes, then I think we would have much more progressive policy in this country. But I think in some ways, one of the takeaways of Joe Biden's win was that this country is a lot more moderate than many progressives wish it was.
Joel, I want to pick up on that because I think that that's we talked a little bit about this on the show yesterday, how Joe Biden may struggle to achieve this sort of party unity that he's been looking for. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you think that in the first couple, 100 days, that there will be some attempts to either placate progressives or move further to the center?
Well, I think what you're seeing are the battle lines being drawn out and how this all shakes out, kind of this period of assessing what happened. I think it will determine how Biden deals with all the different parts of his coalition. I think if you see that most people arrive at the idea that progressives push too far to the left, I think there'll be less pressure on Biden to, whether it's name nominees to his cabinet that are more progressive or lead with agenda items that are more progressive, maybe, you know, kind of like a Green New Deal type of stuff or, you know, progressive taxation, right? Those are the things that the left wanted in exchange for being loyal to Joe Biden during the campaign. Whether or not Biden has a push to do that earlier on, I think this period that we're within right now, where the narratives are being set, I think that that will indicate that. So this is very consequential for how Biden will govern this period of time. And honestly, I do think that, to Charlotte's point, Democrats have to be careful not to alienate that progressive base, because when you think about cities like Philly, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Atlanta, those are the cities that actually delivered this presidency for Joe Biden. And things like police reform and, you know, kind of leveling the playing field between, you know, the wealthy and the less wealthy, those were issues that did drive excitement and enthusiasm for those voters. So it is a very careful balance that Democrats have to consider.
Charlotte, let's pick up on some of the issues, the specific issues that are at the center of this sort of split between more progressive Democrats and more centrist Democrats. Are we talking about things like defunding the police, Medicare for all? What are the real top concerns here for more progressive Democrats?
So, yeah, I think we're talking about Medicare for all. We're talking about a Green New Deal. And we're talking about sort of building this sort of 21st century social safety net that people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren ran on in the primary and really captured particularly young Democrats with that vision. And I think one of the things that Joe Biden was actually very smart about as he, you know, after he sewed up the nomination, was that he reached out to some of the top policy people in the Bernie Sanders camp and said, hey, you know, come form a task force with my campaign. Let's work together. Let's try to hammer out, you know, some places where both the moderate and the progressive wing of the party can kind of find consensus. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, to their credit, the progressive wing of this party really, really got behind Joe Biden in the general election. There we did not see the kind of sniping and backbiting that many felt characterized the 2020 general election, when some of Bernie's supporters didn't really get on board with Hillary Clinton until the very last minute. That didn't happen this time, partly because Biden was very explicit about reaching out a hand and inviting progressives in to offer their ideas. And progressives that I spoke to felt like, you know, there were places where they were never going to agree, but at least they felt heard, they felt respected, they felt like their position was taken seriously. And so I think the question now for Joe Biden is, can he maintain that posture as a president? Can he continue to be a unifier as a president? And also, you know, to what extent does being heard sort of placate this wing of the party if they don't actually necessarily get results from that?
And that's exactly one of the questions, Jola, I'll pose to you, is that if, you know, Joe Biden has said, for example, he's not against fracking, he's not for defunding the police. Those are things that are really important to a lot of progressive Americans. And so, you know, how far is he going to be able to take that centrist stance, you know, when it comes to a significant portion of the Democratic electorate?
You know, that's fair, but I do think that we sometimes get a little reductive in how we talk about these issues. Like, I mean, most people, even most progressives, don't really talk about, quote, defund the police. Really, what you're talking about is like police reform. I mean, there was a bill that a lot of moderates got behind in the Senate Democratic and House caucus that Republicans wouldn't allow movement on. And that was a pretty middle of the road bill. There were some places where they reached, but that's really what we're talking about. You know, Jim Clyburn, I've heard him say sloganeering is a problem here. And I think there's a good point to that. But no,
just to insert here, Joel, I do think it also is particular to this issue, defunding the police. There are those who are straight abolitionists who believe that police departments should be completely abolished. And then there are those who consider more what you're talking about, which is a redistribution of funds to social services programs. I think the folks who want complete abolition are the ones who are not going to be satisfied with Joe Biden's approach.
That's right, Tanzina. And I think what is at issue here is, like, how many people is that really, right? Like, I don't think that that's a majority of Democrats in America who are there, or at least enough to where this should be an issue that Democrats should be focusing on a week after a pretty historic election of Joe Biden and going into power in 2021 with a lot of wind at their back. And I think that's what Democrats like myself probably would hope, is that instead of like cannibalizing each other about this, you know, Democrats maybe quietly deal with family issues as opposed to spending the entire week after the election talking about this. I think that's what's at issue here.
Charlotte, how much of this is generational? Is it really, you know, just a new guard coming in and the old guard, and a lot has been made of the old guard, you know, just in terms of tenure and even, you know, in other areas on both sides of Congress here? I mean, we're seeing folks who've been in these positions, including Joe Biden, for more than 40 years. So how much of this is a generational divide where it's new folks who are coming in saying, we want to see some change?
So I think that it certainly is generational, but it's not quite as cleanly generational as people tend to think. So absolutely, this progressive wing of the party is characterized by this kind of youthful energy. You know, young people tend to really favor a Green New Deal, really favor Medicare for All, really favor free public college. And certainly people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are carrying that mantle. But, you know, the other thing we have to remember is that there also are a lot of young, fresh faces in Congress who are moderates, who are representing the areas that, you know, that kind of actually make or break the political future for Democrats. For example, in Michigan, Haley Stevens, Alyssa Slotkin are also in Congress along with Rashida Tlaib. And, you know, they have just as much of a vote as she does. They represent just as much of Michigan as she does. And they are more moderate than she is. So I think it's a little reductive to say that all young Democrats fall on one side of this progressive to moderate spectrum. One thing that I did find in my research for my book, which is largely about this, is that this younger generation that's coming into Washington, you know, they don't always agree on the solutions, but they do tend to agree on what the problems are. So these young people who are coming in are more concerned about climate change. They're more concerned about college affordability. They're more concerned about equitable access to healthcare. But that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody supports the Green New Deal as it's currently imagined, or everybody supports abolishing private health insurance in favor of Medicare for all. Progressives tend to sometimes present it as if there's broad uniformity, like every young person in America supports this very specific set of legislation exactly as they've been articulated. And it's just a little bit more complicated than that.
That complexity, Joel, is something that has honestly gotten lost in a lot of policy conversations, particularly among Democrats and among uber progressives. I've experienced it myself on social media when talking about things and just asking questions about things like what it means to defund the police, where it can really become you can become unable to even have a conversation about some of this. And I think, Joel, I wonder if progressives are going to feel very frustrated with the next couple of years because of that real sense of it's either this way or no way.
Yeah, that's a good point, Tanzina. I mean, look, progressives struggle to even appreciate the Obama years where you actually had uniformity of kind of government leadership. I worked in Harry Reid's majority leader's office when Democrats had the White House and the Senate and the House. And still, there was a lot of bellyaching from the base. Maybe some of it fair, but a lot of it unfair, because there's a difference between governing and campaigning. And when you govern it, you can't. You know, there is a certain amount of deal making that has to happen, which actually positions Joe Biden pretty well. I think one thing that Biden and his team have done well is not overcommit him. And they've been very adept at setting expectations, even on kind of what happened over the summer related to George Floyd. And you saw how Biden responded to that moment. I actually think he was very agile and he did what the retail politics he needed to do at the moment, but he did not take himself so far out of the mainstream that it was a position that was going to hurt him with the entire coalition. So I actually think Biden might be uniquely qualified to manage this moment. But yes, progressives are always going to be frustrated with the governing process. That is something I have learned from about 15 years in and around, Democratic politics at the national level. And I imagine that's going to continue into the near future.
Joel, I have to ask you about this campaign in terms of finance, in terms of the amount of money that went into this campaign for the Democrats. I mean, there were races here that had seen, especially following the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, donations flowing into Democratic Senate candidates and even Joe Biden. How would you characterize how much was spent this year for the Dems?
Well, there were ungodly sums of money that were spent, and Democrats have always had a kind of uneasy relationship with that much money and you know, what we spend on how we elect people. As you know, I'm sure Tanzina, I'm sure Charlotte can speak to this as well. The Citizens United case was something that was very, very corrosive to a lot of people who vote like me and who think like me. But you also understand that if those are the rules, you have to live by those rules. And I do think, you know, Democrats were able to do that effectively this cycle. I think the one thing I will say is that the money raised and the money spent does serve as somewhat of a barometer of energy. And I think energy and enthusiasm was high on the Democratic side. That's why you had a lot of money raised. By the way, it wasn't all like, you know, Wall Street donors, you know, raised money. It was small and mid dollar fundraisers from people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Biden finally got his fundraising apparatus up to that over the summer after he was the presumptive nominee. But it wasn't your traditional, bundler driven fundraising operation that Democrats had. There was a really strong small and mid dollar operation that Democrats and that Biden were able to lead. I imagine they will continue to be able to do that. We'll see another test of it, by the way, in a couple of weeks with that Georgia runoff, the double runoff in Georgia with the Purdue seat and also the open seat that Raphael Warnock and Kelly Loeffler are going to be going after.
Charlotte, to that point, I mean, let's talk a little bit about what effect the Biden win, or at least for now, has on the energy and activism that comes from the left, particularly the progressive left. Are you seeing, let's look at Georgia, you know, are there going to be people mobilized to try and turn that Senate race blue, shift the balance of power there? Do you see that Biden's win has actually energized progressives?
So I do think that there's going to be a tremendous amount of energy and money focused on Georgia. I think it's an open question as to whether or not that energy is necessarily, you know, fairly characterized as progressive, as the way progressives define it. You know, I don't think either John Ossoff or Reverend Warnock are in the AOC style of progressive. And I think that this gets back to what I was saying earlier about how, you know, what works in the Bronx and in Detroit and in, you know, the Boston area is not necessarily what's going to win Senate seats in Georgia. And I think nobody knows that better than Stacey Abrams. And so one of the lessons that Democrats learned very well in 2018 was to let the people, to let locals do the local organizing, to focus on what works in that particular district, in that particular state, in that particular region, without getting lashed to a national narrative. And I think that's much harder in a presidential campaign where you do have somebody at the top of the ticket, where you do have the party making nationwide decisions about who it is and what it stands for. And I think that's why you're seeing these tensions erupt, because in 2018, it was much easier for you know, Stacey Abrams to run on her issues and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to run on her issues and Ayanna Pressley to run on her issues. And those didn't all have to be the same. And 2020, you know, sort of required the Democratic Party to come into a little bit more consensus. And that's where all this tension is coming from.
Joel, I want to round out this conversation by asking you about the fact that when Joe Biden gave his speech, presumably accepting, announcing that they had won over the weekend, at least the Electoral College votes, he made it very clear to point out his support from one of the largest voting blocks for Democrats, which is Black Americans. And he pointed and said, "You have had my back, and I will have yours." I'm paraphrasing there. But what is that going to look like, Joel? I mean, how will Joe Biden be able to keep that promise to Black voters?
I think Black voters will be reminding him of it at every turn. It's really poetic if you think about it. Black voters delivered the primary to Joe Biden when really, I mean, by all accounts, Joe Biden did not perform well in that Democratic primary. His campaign was always better for the general than for the primary. But when he was at the kind of bottom of the barrel in South Carolina, Black voters just looked at the field and just said, "This stops here, this stops now." And starting in South Carolina and going through those SEC primary states, Mississippi, Alabama, et cetera, they decided that Joe Biden was going to be the standard bearer of the party. They are the darkest blue block of Democratic voters, particularly Black women, and they delivered that primary to him. And if you actually look on what happened during the election, they delivered the election to Joe Biden. Again, in cities like Philly, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Milwaukee, Atlanta, that was Black voters who put Joe Biden over the top in a way that they were not able to do for Hillary Clinton. And I think a lot of African-American voters took that personally, particularly, again, those really reliable African-American voters in that block. And I think that they just decided that Joe Biden was the only person that could beat Donald Trump. And that was the existential crisis. And I think that that was kind of level one. It was kind of a two-step process. Level one, beat Trump. Level two, be able to hold Biden accountable, and I think that they certainly will.
Joel Payne is a Democratic strategist and host of the podcast Here Comes the Pain, and Charlotte Alter is a senior correspondent at Time and author of The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all for us today, folks. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. We had a little bit of a glitch with our phone yesterday, so if you got a busy signal, call us back. We're up and running again, and we'll hear some of your thoughts later in the week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.